Now the voices of the men and women whose words and deeds made the news. This week's Voices and Events.
Voices and Events. From London to San Francisco, from Washington to Korea, here are the actual voices of the people who made the news, recorded as they made it by the NBC News and Special Events Department. The sounds of history in our time. Now, the editor of Voices and Events, James Fleming.
This week, a poet died. Edna St. Vincent Millay was 58. In her youth, she'd written of candles burning at both ends, giving lovely light. But over a decade ago, perhaps sensing with a poet's intuition the threats to free men, Edna St. Vincent Millay spoke out to warn her countrymen, wrote an ironic verse to stir them.
Ease has demoralized us, nearly so. We know nothing of the rigors of winter. The house has a roof against, the car a top against. The snow. All will be well, we say. It is a habit, like the rising of the sun, for our country to prosper. Who can prevail against us? No one.
That was Edna St. Vincent Millay in the autumn of 1939. Last Thursday, in Pittsburgh, we were to hear a similar earnest admonition to the American people. Not in a poet's cadence this time, but in the spare prose of a soldier, General Dwight Eisenhower.
We Americans must realize that we cannot buy out, talk away, or ignore the menace of totalitarian aggression. So long as it persists in its course, we must be ready to stop it. Our future, in duration and content, depends on our present willingness to work, to serve, to sacrifice, to subordinate our ease, our plans, our pleasures, to the hard necessities of the country's safety and the world's freedom. This applies to every one of us.
So it was another week when issues of war and peace intertwined the fabric of almost every news event. As the week began, most reporters expected clarification of our policy in Asia. After all, the president had met with MacArthur, something must have come of it. On Wake Island, our microphones eavesdropped as Mr. Truman boarded his plane. You'll hear General MacArthur shouting his farewell to the president and adding a personal word to General Omar Bradley, first, though, the ever-present photographers.
One more, Mr. President, before we
end. Oh.
That's the idea.
Happy landing to you.
Thank you.
Happy landing to you.
Thank you.
It's been a real honor to talk with you.
Goodbye, Omar. Take care of
yourself. Tuesday night, President Truman spoke to the nation from the San Francisco Opera House. As NBC's Frank Burgholzer pointed out from the scene, the atmosphere was exceedingly nonpartisan.
The presidential staff has labored to keep this a non-political meeting. Candidates from both parties have been invited. Helen Gehagan Douglas, for example, sitting just a few seats from us behind Republican Senator William Noland of California. Governor Earl Warren in a box, and Democratic candidate Jimmy Roosevelt a few rows back. The president obviously wants to clearly separate this matter of war and peace.
As he spoke at this birthplace of the United Nations, President Truman chose to deal with broad issues of foreign policy rather than any detailed report of his meeting with MacArthur.
The Soviet Union and its colonial satellites are maintaining armed forces of great size and strength in both Europe and Asia. Their vast armies pose a constant threat to world peace. So long as they persist in maintaining these forces and in using them to intimidate other countries, the free men of the world have but one choice if they are to remain free. They must oppose strength with strength.
Mr. Truman added that if Russia wants peace, it could prove it by lifting the Iron Curtain, joining in a workable system of collective security. To the people of Asia, he proposed a partnership for peace. The president's journey to Wake Island had been widely criticized by Republicans as a political junket. Harold Stassen had said,
"There's a very disquieting report here in Washington. It is a report that this flight to the Pacific did not arise from any conferences with the president's diplomatic or defense officials. The report is that it arose in a conference with his Missouri political friends during the evening hour on board his yacht in Chesapeake Bay.
I understand that there's been speculation about why I made this trip. There's really no mystery about it. I went because I wanted to see and talk to General MacArthur. The best way to see and talk to him was to meet him somewhere and talk to him. I also felt that there was pressing need to make it perfectly clear by my talk with General MacArthur that there was complete unity in the aims and conduct of our foreign policy. I went out to Wake Island to see General MacArthur because I did not want to take him far away from Korea. Events are moving swiftly over there now.
Indeed they are. U.N. forces have captured the North Korean capital. U.S. parachute troops, personally directed by MacArthur, cut off fugitive Reds north of that city. The foot soldiers were mopping up, and modern weapons such as flamethrowers speeded the process. Under fire, our reporters talked to some GIs fighting with this deadly weapon.
Open that old baby up in that hole. Watch them guys come out. It's the only way you get them out. They threw grenades in there. And we had to go up with the throwers. And as soon as we gave them a blast with the throwers, well, they came running out then. They were pretty glad to see us up there. The Howe Company was. That's the first time we're committed in action.
Well, don't you find it rather heavy carrying the thing around?
It's pretty heavy, but it drops down about 47 pounds after you empty it. It weighs about 72 when it's fully loaded, ready to fire.
I wish you could put some of that flame on the tank that's shooting at us right now.
Is that what's shooting at us?
I said we'd get a little bit mad about carrying it around before, but now we got to use it today. I'm sure as hell glad I had it. You got all the rest of the men to cover you, and they're all around, and then you get up there close. You got good protection all around from it. The rest of the boys won't let you down. We all come down the hill, and then they seen this big hole or cave, whatever you want to call it, and I don't know, they just, whether they threw grenades out of there first or not, but they hollered for flamethrowers, and Beak was the first one up there, and he filled her full, boy, and they come.
Tell us about that.
It pretty scared me pretty well. I was forward of the riflemen. And after I let one burst go, why, they started coming out of their holes there.
Guys all over the place, boy.
Well, the riflemen cover you pretty well, so there's nothing to worry about there.
South Korean forces were ordered to press on to their northern frontiers. The Korean Reds set up a new capital on the Manchurian border itself. From General MacArthur, an optimistic statement proclaiming the beginning of the end. To fighting men of all services, a hearty well done. Here's how Marine Commandant Cates put it the other day as he spoke to flyers in Korea.
Gentlemen, I can't tell you how much the people in America appreciate the work that you're doing. It's just unbelievable the praise that we are getting back there in the Marine Corps. And congratulations for a job well done. Thank you.
So we had stopped the aggressor in Korea. One could only speculate what the course of history might have been had the Western powers stopped aggression in the Orient back in 1931 when the Japanese first took over Manchuria. The man who in that year proposed a united front to stop them died at week's end. Henry L. Stimson had served in the cabinets of four presidents. He was 83.
This was National Letter Writing Week. It really was.
Yes, Bob, but politicians weren't proclaiming that fact. Their motto had become, don't write, telephone. More of that in a moment. First, let's check up on the campaigners. Some thought the barnstorming Vice President Barkley was kissing too many babies of all ages, but Washington wit George Allen didn't agree.
No, I think he's been in politics for about 50 years, and he started kissing babies, and they just growing up now. That's perfectly normal. I don't think that's unfair at all.
And when the Veep found himself on the same platform with Governor Dewey this week, Mr. Barkley explained that he really wasn't campaigning at all.
I am not in the position of Governor Dewey. I am not a candidate for any office. And I'm not and I am not engaged in a political campaign. I have been traveling considerably over this country in the last few weeks, explaining to the American people the science of government.
For Thomas E. Dewey, it was, to say the least, a busy week. It began with the governor's reply to reporter Leo Egan on Meet the Press.
Well, Governor, would it be possibility that you might get another crack at the Republican nomination for president in 1952, another reason for changing your mind?
No, Leo, that one is out. I am definitely and finally removed. I removed myself by a letter. That's about 18 months ago, and that is beyond consideration.
Well, Governor, if you're not going to run, do you have any candidates in mind?
Well, it's a little early, but if I should be reelected governor and to have influence with the New York delegation, I would recommend to them that they support General Eisenhower for president if he would accept the draft.
Well, Ike, from his point of vantage on Morningside Heights, allowed us how he wasn't over-anxious. Governor Dewey went on to meet about the roughest situation of his campaigning career. His senatorial running mate, Joe Hanley, had written a letter to an anti-Dewey Republican. Democratic National Chairman Clinton Anderson was delighted to publicize its contents.
Hanley's letter is pitifully frank as to the means of persuasion, the clearing of his personal debts, the promise of a state job, the lure of financial security for the rest of his life. It shocks the conscience of every lover of decency in government, and its reverberations will be heard in every state this fall.
But Joe Hanley, running against Democratic Senator Lehman, insisted that no pressure had been put on him to step aside for Dewey.
I faced a crisis last summer. A very great personal crisis. I made my decision because of my feeling that this nation, in this terrible time of conflict, needed the best man available to guide her. And therefore, I came to here myself, to New York, and I asked the greatest executive this state has ever had and the best citizen to lead it in emergency to do that thing again. And that's why I asked Thomas E. Dewey to run for governor.
But Dewey's Democratic opponent, Representative Lynch, wouldn't let the GOP forget the Hanley letter.
I was shocked, like every other citizen of New York has been shocked, by this sordid disclosure of bartering away public office.
No such thing had happened, said Governor Dewey. He had made no deal with Hanley. They met and talked early in September, true, but it was all open and above board.
And the next day we had lunch, and we talked it all over. And as he left, having told me that he would run, he said, if I should lose, of course you know I'll need a place. And I said to him, as I had said many times before, Joe, I would be proud to have you in the state government. And everybody who is listening, I want you to know, Joe Hanley is my friend and I love him.
Then the Republicans found a letter, this one of Senator Lehman's to Alger Hiss, written before the latter's perjury conviction. Lehman pointed out that John Foster Dulles had written a similar letter to Hiss in 1948, and so the battle went. But something seemed to be missing in this year's campaign oratory, and looking to the record of history, we noted that in the past, campaigners seemed to be a bit more colorful. Al Smith, for example. Let's listen to the happy warrior at the height of his powers as he kept an unruly audience in the palm of his hand.
Order, please. Remember, we're losing time on the radio. Some of the old-time orators of Tammany Hall, they just used to make the rafters of that old building in 14th Street shake in their denunciation of the bureaucracy. Turn down those lights, young fella. Turn out the lights there. Who has charge of the lights? That's the way to do it. Now, let me say this. Somebody is going to be double-crossed. Who is it going to be?
Did someone suggest that politics hasn't changed much since Al Smith's time? His memory was honored this week by five famous young ladies from Canada. Annette, Cecile, Yvonne, Marie, and Emily, the Dion Quintuplets. Very much the young ladies now, visiting the big city for the first time. They came to New York to assist the Al Smith Foundation, and they sang The Sidewalks of New York. It was a delightful moment, even though Mamie O'Rourke became Mammy O'Rourke from these French-speaking young ladies.
Listening to Voices and Events, the living record of history this week in the voices of the people who made the news. All over the world, NBC correspondents have been on the scene reporting and recording events as they happen to make possible this first-hand account of the never-ending story that is the news. Now again, here is the editor of Voices and Events, James Fleming.
Next, the stories of three men, an author, a baseball pioneer, and a vegetarian. Two of them retired this week, but one, rather retiring in the past, was really getting around. He was author W. Somerset Maugham, and we caught him the other day as he talked to some ladies of the press.
Having been extremely busy and having only known about this 48 hours ago, I haven't prepared a thing to say to you. And so I was extremely curious to know what the subject was. And as far as I remember, she said it was the character of women or the women of character. I can't remember which it was. Some years ago, for a job I was engaged on, I had to read the lives of several of the greatest authors the world has seen. The conclusion after studying all these lives that I came to is enjoy the company of authors if you like, but don't marry them. Thank you.
Baseball pioneer Connie Mack stepped down as manager of the Philadelphia Athletics this week after 50 years. No player had ever dared call this aloof and able Irishman Connie. He was always Mr. Mack. But when Connie Mack talked to youngsters, he was quite another person.
Is your real name Connie Mack?
Well, Auguste, I'll tell you, to be frank with you, no, it's not. It's a very long name. And it was cut down so that the newspaper boys would have a chance to get it in once in a while. The real name was Cornelius McGillicuddy.
Mr. Mack, I heard that you were an awful good man, and that whenever you do get mad and swear, the worst thing you say is, "My gracious," is that true?
Well, Freddie, I guess that's pretty near true, because I don't like to hear the swearing. I tell them that swearing never helped any ball player's success.
Our vegetarian, of course, is Sir Stafford Cripps. Illness has forced him to retire as chief of Britain's treasury. The British people, knowing his personal ways, called him Mr. Austerity. But they also came to know of his sense of humor, as we did at a recent press conference.
I imagine that a great many of the dollar prices of British exports will remain where they are today. Take, for instance, Scotch whiskey. As far as I know from my experience, and it's a very limited one in America, there's no need whatsoever to reduce the dollar price of Scotch whiskey.
Cripps' successor as Chancellor of the Exchequer is former deputy Hugh Gaitskill.
This week, Voices and Events reports on a country that has maintained neutrality in a warring world for nearly a century and a half. A report on Switzerland.
That isn't a trombone you're hearing. It's an ancient instrument called an alpine horn, and its commanding tones have echoed through the mountains for centuries. Our reporter flew by Swiss Air to Bern last week to record this, as well as other sounds and voices reflecting the spirit of the people. Here is a country of 4 million with an army of 600,000 men trained and ready. It's as though the United States had a ready force of over 20 million. Every youth goes through his period of training. Those are the rough boots of mountaineer forces. After his initial service, every Swiss male spends 3 weeks a year in training until the age of 36. He keeps his weapons at home.
My name is Sven Guckisberg. Every year I spend 3 weeks in the army on training and on maneuvers. We work hard, get up early. Sometimes we sleep on straw, sometimes not at all. We do a lot of shooting and all of us take our guns and uniform home. Of course, the guns must be kept clean. That's what I'm doing here.
To the chief of operations of the Swiss Army, we put the question, how swiftly could full mobilization be accomplished?
My name is Burkhardt. I'm Lieutenant Colonel of the Swiss Federal Staff, and I'm chief of operations.
The army would be mobilized within the lapse of time of about 1 day. Two-thirds of the army would be ready to fight within 18 hours.
What's this Swiss soldier like? Is he a paragon among GIs, or does he grumble as much as the soldier of any other country? This was Colonel Burkhardt's answer.
I don't think that there are any soldiers who do not grumble. The Swiss grumble, I think, just as much as any other soldier.
And the Swiss army has its songs, perhaps less strident than the average martial air. This one, for example, is the Reveille song. It doesn't suggest that these soldiers hate to get up in the morning. Within the last century, the Swiss Army has been mobilized on only three occasions, in 1870, 1914, and 1939. The threats to this natural fortress remained only threats. The world has changed a good deal since 1939, but the Swiss are stronger than ever in affirming their neutrality. They've recognized, though, that it's a smaller world. They've kept a pace in communications by launching their own international airline. A typical Swiss citizen with a world point of view is Swiss Air's president, Walter Berchtold.
Some people reproach Switzerland for being neutral. They say she is indifferent, even egoistic, not concerned with the affairs of the world. This is nonsense. Switzerland is a small country whose very existence is highly endangered by every hostile outbreak around her. Yet she accepts the heavy burden of maintaining a well-trained army in order to defend her democratic institutions against any aggressor. If not attacked, she is capable of accomplishing a more positive task by remaining neutral than by allowing herself to be drawn into the war.
There's no question of Swiss sympathies in the conflict between East and West. The noted editor of the Neue Zürcher Zeitung, Willy Brechter, put it this way.
Yes, Switzerland has enjoyed more than 100 years of peace. In the past, our neutrality was always bound up with the principle of a balance of power in Europe. But now, you know, Europe is no longer the natural center of power. It is a ravaged continent, divided by what you call it, the Iron Curtain, the Iron Vorhang. There is no question where the synthesis of the Swiss people lie. To the Swiss, their freedom, their individual rights,
mean as much as they do to the Americans. But neutrality must still guide our official policy. We think neutrality is worthless unless the whole population is prepared to defend it with guns in their hands.
In Switzerland, then, today, the price of liberty and neutrality is eternal vigilance. And in the age of the atom, the Swiss, as always, guard the mountains, the tunnels, hoping that the fortress given them by nature will survive the weapons of the 20th century.
You have been listening to a new departure in radio journalism. Voices and Events. This week's living history. The voices of the people who made the news recorded as they made it. The sounds of history. James Fleming is the editor and narrator of Voices and Events. This is Robert Warren inviting you to listen next week at this Sunday hour when the NBC News and Special Events Department brings you the never-ending story that is the news on Voices and Events. These weekly broadcasts of Voices and Events are made possible by new techniques of reporting and tape recording pioneered by the NBC News and Special Events Department. Enjoy the exciting Falcon and Charlie Wilde today on NBC.